Thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this free podcast from Celtic Underground. You can subscribe and like and listen to your podcast wherever you pick up your podcast feed. You can also subscribe at theCelticUnderground.substack.com, where you will get email notification of new content as soon as it is out. And you can subscribe for free, or there'll be plenty of free content, articles and podcasts. But also, you can pay a small subscription and you'll get extra special content. Anyway, enough of me. On to today's free podcast. I am joined now by Matthew from Hail Hail History. How are you doing, Matthew?
I'm great. Thanks very much for having me on tonight.
That's okay. So listeners to Celtic Underground will be aware that Matthew's been doing some audio history stuff for us, and there'll be plenty more to come from them. There's one we've got Hearts. I can't remember what order I'm putting stuff out with podcasts, but there's one for the Hearts game about to come up before the Hearts game gets played. But before I do that, although you do Celtic's history and you've already shown your credentials on our site by doing that, on this podcast we have to get your real Celtic credentials. So I have to check out, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero? Which always dates people as well. So you go.
The hero's easy. The game, I don't know, and it's a real point of annoyance. I first went in 1981, when I would be... Well, my dad isn't sure. This is the problem. This is why I don't know. I was either just two or I was younger than two. And my dad my dad can't remember. We've looked at fixtures around that time and it's just not the type of thing he pays a huge amount of attention to.
Yeah.
So I started going, as I say, in 81. I think I started going regularly 87. I think, you know, inevitably, I have no recollection of my first game, obviously, you know, given the age I went to. And I went on and off occasionally, and I think I just hadn't really connected with me football yet at that age. It was something my dad did, but I didn't really take that great interest. And then I think even to the point, my mum and dad my mum doesn't like football particularly, but they'd sort of both spoke about it's the centenary season, so it's about 87. I sort of went to dad and said, actually, I want to come, and I started going, and that was really it from then on. You know, we went to most home games, away games. Dad was a shift worker, so you went obviously when you could. I think the games I really remember, the early games I really remember are certainly the trophy day in the centenary season, so Dunfermline rather than Dundee, the Scottish Cup final. But I actually see the game that season, and I think it's the game that really made me love football. Was Hogmanay in 88, and we beat Hearts 4-2. Mm-hmm. Billy Starr scored two, Mark McGee scored two, John Robertson scored twice for Hearts, and it was one of those back-and-forth games. We went 1-1 up, they equalised, 2-1 up, they equalised, 3-2, 4-2, and it was just brilliant. I think it was the first game, so I would be at that point. I had just turned 9, and I just thought this was so exciting. I just thought this had been just such an amazing game, and I think... although I'd been a few times before that, that was the game that really in my head made me go, oh, this is the sort of the thing for me. This is sort of what I want to do. And just from then on, I went consistently. I mean, eventually, by 92, we got the first season ticket. I've had the season ticket since 92.
Right.
And I think that was because, I think before that, we could have had a season ticket, but Dad always worried that being younger, I would turn and go one day, I'm not wanting to go.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been furious. But by the time I was 92, I was old enough that my dad would let me go with his friend, so I could go even if Dad was at work, so he didn't mind getting the season ticket. So the first season ticket we had, well, I say for the Jungle, we used to go to the Jungle. It was the 92-93 season, and then we had the seated Jungle. We stayed in the Jungle for that, Hampden, and then I've been in the same seat back at Celtic Park since 95 now, so I sit right above the Green Brigade. And yeah, it's great. But yeah, it feels, it does date you when you think to yourself, God, I've been going for more than 40 years now.
Yeah, and then when you then start to think a wee bit more, and there are people who, you know, a bit like you, my first Celtic game, I know it was against Arbroath. And so I had it in my head I was four, but when I look at Celtic's fixtures against Arbroath, I think I might have been, I was only about three.
Mm.
Because it's a game that I can remember against Clyde Bank, which was too close to the Arbroath game for, and we also, I went to an away game against Hibs and we lost 2-1. And but by where those two games are, it must mean I was only three. Yet I can remember that game. So the reason I've never, but you then start thinking, wow, and there are people who've been going a lot longer than me. And, you know, you start to sound really old when you say, as you say, I've been going for over 40 years, or in my case, 50 years. And then you know there are people who've been going way longer than you that really...
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the supporters bus I used to go on, I won't name check him because he's very private, but the guy that runs the bus, who still runs the bus, has been running the bus since the 60s, has literally been, if you want to name a major Celtic game since World War II, and I mean that sincerely, he was there. Coronation Cup final, 7-1, Lisbon, Milan in 1970, genuinely has been at every single one of these, you know, and God, you think to yourself, you know, I'm not quite sure. I don't, will I still be going then? I mean, I hope so.
I would like to think, yeah, I would like to think that someone will go, wow, tell me about Seville. Well,
but you see, I think that's the funny thing. The funny thing about getting older, one of my friends has talked about this quite a lot, and he says it's really funny when you begin to realise your own age. So he gives the analogy. He used to go on one of the Lennox Town buses. Mm-hmm. And he gives the scenario. He says, I remember, he says, I started going in the, you know, on my own. I was allowed to go on my own in the 80s. He says, and I remember there was all these, you know, you had the old guys on the bus who would talk about Celtic, even, you know, even into the 30s, but certainly into the 40s and around that era, you know, talking about, obviously, about relegation, which almost came about in the 40s. So they would talk about all that. He says, and you would, on the one hand, you would listen and be interested. He says, but on the other hand, you'd be like, God, these old guys, that was like, that must have been the same time as dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And then the funny thing is, he's like, now, he says, the other day on the bus, I was talking to some young boys about the 80s. And I thought to myself, if you look at the age difference, he says, that's exactly the same. Like me talking to them about the 80s is the same as these old guys that used to in the 80s talk to me about the 40s. Aye. He says, and that's when it really blew my mind going, God, I'm really not young anymore.
I mean, I'll often do that to try and give some context to something that still, that doesn't seem ancient to me. I'll then put it in the context of, right, okay, like say, Oasis were recently in the news, right? So that's 30 years ago. And you then think, yeah, but somebody talking now about the excitement of getting Oasis tickets in 2024 would be like somebody in 1994 talking about going to see the Beatles just as they break through in 64. In 64, well, if someone was talking to me about the Beatles in 1994, I'd have been thinking, you are ancient, because that is ancient history. So I always like to do that to give you context and give yourself a reality check about...
Absolutely.
Don't go on so much about
I once chose, and I mean in the 90s, I chose Celtic over Oasis. And I would absolutely do the same again. I know some people go, you're mad. And it was my first ever job. It was my first job. So I was still at school and my mum was very much, you need to get a job, you need to get a job, like a part-time job. And my dad wanted me to get one as well, but he wanted me to go to the football. And obviously it can be quite hard to get a non-Saturday job.
Yep.
You know, if you're just wanting, because obviously a lot of the time it is a Saturday job if you want part-time stuff and you're still at school. And so I remember I'd applied loads of places and I couldn't get anywhere that would let me basically not work on a Saturday. And then I, one day I got a call, supermarket, can you come in? That was fine, brilliant. So I went in. So we did all the usual chat and that. And the guy was like, right, that's great. Yeah, I'm going to start you. And I thought, perfect. And he went, so your hours are going to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night and Saturday. And I actually, despite the fact I was only 16, I was confident enough to say, I says, look, I'm really sorry. I did say in my application, if you look at it, you know, I'm not, I can't work Saturdays. And he wasn't happy. He was like, oh, but I really need someone, right? I need someone. Okay. He says, right, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I really need someone for those days, so I'm going to hire you. He says, you'll have to do a Sunday once a month. So that's non-negotiable. I says, that's fine. He says, I don't want you taking time off to go to the football. And I went, no, that's okay. I won't be. I says, I'm really reliable. I'm never late. I'm never sick or anything like that. And then he said, right, so you're going to start this coming Monday, which was a night that Oasis were playing at Ingolstadt.
Right.
And I had tickets for that, you know, everyone was really excited about. And I remember thinking, I can't chance my arm here. I've just taken out an entire day of the week. If I hadn't done that, I would have said, look, can I start the Tuesday? But I thought, if I ask for this Monday, the first Monday that I'm supposed to work off, he's going to just tell me to shut the door on the way out. So I made the decision, and I would happily do it again, that if I had to choose between seeing Celtic or Oasis, then every single time, that would be my choice.
And I would go and see Oasis too, but yes, I would pick Celtic over that every time. So who was your first Celtic hero?
I think this will obviously date me in that way. I think Paul McStay was always the consistent one. I think that at various times you liked others. You know, I really liked Joe Miller, for example. And I remember vividly my dad going to the 89 final. And that should have been my first ever Celtic Rangers game. And I'd been told beforehand, my dad said, right, if I get tickets before the game, I'll take you. He says, I'm not taking you through and chancing it, though. He says, I'm not doing that. So if we get tickets beforehand, you can go. And he didn't. And he didn't even get himself. He went through on the day and he managed to pick one up, which is easy enough there. And I just remember my mum shouting at him because I'd been saying before he left, I bet Joe Miller, bet Joe Miller scores the winner. And when he came home, I remember him dancing along the garden's front wall with my mum shouting at him to get back in. And all the time he was shouting, despite it was the fact it was me, he said, I told you wee Joe would do it, you know. So I really liked the likes of Miller. I really liked Jackanowski. I think just because he was a striker and there was an excitement.
Well, we'd spent money on a foreign player, which was
And Partizan Belgrade. I mean, I couldn't get my head around how away goals worked that night. I mean, at that night, I was right at the very front of the Celtic end, right down at the corner flag beside the main stand, right leaning on the dike. And I couldn't understand. I'm like, how have we lost? Like, we didn't lose. We won 5-4. And I couldn't understand. I just couldn't understand how the away goal system worked. But so I liked all those. I liked Joe Miller. I liked Jackanowski. I liked them. But Paul McStay was just, I think because he was the consistent one, especially going from when you first remember starting going to almost more of an adulthood, an adolescence. And I think because he was the consistent one, then I think McStay is always the one for me that stands out. Obviously, you have individual players that, you know, Jackanowski, Miller. I really liked Paul Elliott, for example. I thought he was a great defender. But for somebody that consistently lasted then it would definitely be for me, Bu McStay.
Yeah, he was... He was a class act. I continually say that I would just, every time we got a group of midfielders that are coming through the B team, I would lock them in a room with about 12 hours of Paul McStay videos and say, if you can aspire to be anything like that, then you'll have a long career. That's your job. Try and be that. Because he was just everything. And, you know, he was one of these people that is you often see about people who are really good at a sport. They just seem to have more time to do the same stuff as everybody else. They just seem to have an extra second to be able to do it than other people. And he was just, in fact, there was a picture on, I think, I saw him on a picture of him on Twitter recently, and I thought, God, you look like you could still play. You know, he still looks young. So that's your grounding of it. So for the listeners who are not familiar, you've obviously done some audio stuff for us. So for listeners who are not familiar, you're on Twitter as the Hail Hail History. And so tell us all about the history stuff that you've been doing, book tours, all the stuff that you do as to why you're doing history stuff on the podcast now.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think on a personal level, I've always had an interest in history. It was what I did my degree in. It's what I do every day in my job. So, you know, I have that huge element. And I think a lot of this, it goes back to some extent to childhood, in the sense of, I can remember that whenever you would go into my my mum and dad's room, there was a bookcase and it was just full of Celtic books, a Lisbon medal, a sort of an equivalent Lisbon medal, and lots of Celtic books. And that I would go in and I would look at these books, and I remember when I got my first Celtic book, and if you're of a similar-ish age to me, you'll probably remember the book that was called The Will to Win. And it was like a sort of a cartoon version of the club's history, an illustrated version of the club's history. And I remember getting that. And I mean, I can't even think how many times when I was younger I read that book. I could have, you almost up to the point, if you just said to me, what's on page 97, could have told you word for word every sort of thing. And I could have drawn the sketches because it was just something you were really obsessed with. And it's been a big part, I've always just had an interest in history generally. A lot of the stuff that I've started doing more in recent times, so as you mentioned, I've got the Twitter page, I've been running history walking tours for the last year and a half, and I published a book last year as well, about the club's first league title, which you can still get in the Celtic shops. And a lot of that came about, and I suppose there's probably a lot of people who've got similar stories. The catalyst to moving from I'm quite interested in Celtic history and I've got a lot of books and read to I'm going to do something about it was COVID. COVID obviously transformed everyone's life. And suddenly, I mean, I'm quite active. I do a lot of sport. I still play football. I go to the games. And I know I've got a job as well. And so I'm always doing something. And then suddenly along came COVID, and you couldn't leave the house. There was no football for me to play. There was no football to go to. And it became, well, what are you going to do at times with your spare time? What are you actually going to do? And that was where the trigger was right. I thought for years I'm going to write a book. I'm actually going to now do it. So I started up. I think I'd opened a Twitter page years ago. I'd never used it. So I just went one day, do you know what? I'm going to try this. I'm going to try and start every day, publish a wee basic fact or something, see where it goes from there. I'd started in that. Through that, you started speaking to some people that had had experience in publishing, like books, Celtic books in particular, before. And from there, it was then the catalyst to, like, I'm actually going to do the research. I did the research and I wrote it. And I wrote it, the thing is, I wrote it quite quickly in the end. I mean, once I had the research done, I remember thinking to myself, right, this is going to take me about a year to write, because, by the time you actually go through it, and then because I'm a fidget and I can't really leave something if I want it done. So what I thought was going to take a year, I think was done about 3 or 4 months later because I just forced myself to actually do it. And from there, a lot of the other stuff has just sort of stemmed from that. The walking tours that I've been running, that came about because of the book. So for people that, perhaps are interested in that, because the walking tours are all free, I don't charge for them. They're really about, if anyone wants, people always say, oh, can we pay you? And I always send them to like a charity site, because I'm not interested personally in getting money. I know this sounds a bit twee, but if we talk about if you know the history, well, the only way you know the history is if people tell you it, is if people actually give them the opportunities. So I set the walking tours website up, so that's celticwalkingtours.wordpress.com. And periodically, I do various walks. That stemmed from the book because I was thinking for things on how to publish and promote the book. And I thought to myself, well, the 9th of May, 2023 was the 135th, sorry, the 130th anniversary, the exact night that Celtic at Celtic Park, at the current Celtic Park site, had won the league. And I thought, well, I'm going to do a walk that tells the story of that inaugural league title. And I really enjoyed it, and it was a lovely night. It helped, the weather was good, and I quite enjoyed it. So I thought, okay, I'll do another one. So I did another one in August, and people kept joking about, oh, what if only you had pubs on it. So I thought, I'm going to do a tour with pubs on it. So one of the tours I do is a match day tour. Next one's actually Saturday for the Hearts game, where we leave the city centre, we walk to the ground, we go to 2 or 3 pubs, and we stop at different sites on the way. And there's various other ones I've done. I mean, just at the weekend past, was so it's 160 years since Brother Walfred became Brother Walfred. So I did a special tour just last weekend, telling the story of basically Wilfred's time in Glasgow, and of course the connections that has to Celtic. And I think, you know, people really like them. I think for a lot of people who come on, it's quite good. You know, there's a socialising opportunity. People, you know, you can talk to obviously other Celtic supporters on the tour. There's just a fitness thing. It's getting you out. And it's also about, again, actually teaching the history, because because every tour I do, the bit I like best is I say something like, do you know what that is over there? Like that vacant waste ground or something.
Mm-hmm.
And people go, no. Like, so even at the weekend, I'd say, that's where Celtic won their first trophy. And it was great because a couple of boys went, that's exactly where I park. He says, every single home game, that's where I park. He says, and I've never ever, you know, I would have had no idea and no way to know that every time I'm getting out, that, you know, if you could somehow transport me back to May 1889, I'd be standing on effectively on the site where it happened. So I like when people get to learn things. And on a personal level, I think it's about doing something as well with what you know. I say I've done a lot. I do a lot of Celtic reading. I've done loads of research. And you could just keep it to yourself, and that's fine. But the only, to me, the real value in doing it is if you then give other people the opportunity to learn things. So from my perspective, that's what this has all been about. And when, you know, when I was contacted and asked if I would start doing the, you know, the Celtic Underground stuff, I thought, well, that's great, because I've already got a bank of stuff. You know, it's not even a, right, I'm going to start from scratch. I've got hundreds of stuff put aside that I can do. Yes, I'll write new stuff as I go along and research new stuff, but a lot of it's there, and it's the wider an opportunity there is for people to learn about it, then I think that can only be a really interesting and good thing.
And the thing about it is, I mean, I like, obviously we used to have the Tales in the Celtic Wiki, and we've been putting some of those old ones back up. I like the fact that it's a, you know, I like doing sort of 5-10 minute snapshot, that you're not having to go into massive detail into, I mean, that can be of interest at times, but just a 10 minute snapshot of, and so we had a Celtic Wiki one out yesterday, I think it was, and it was Bertie of the Celtic, and it was Bertie, whose surname escapes me just now, but he was playing in the same team as John Thompson and Jimmy McGrory, and I was, as I was listening to it, and it was talking about how 10,000 people had turned up at his funeral because he died and he was a young man, and I was listening to it and I was just thinking about how the comments we were just making about you get older and the world moves on and that's in the past, and what I like about what you do and reviving that is reminding, you know, we do celebrate the fact that we have a glorious history of 130 odd years of the club, and there are people who in the moment were considered irreplaceable at Celtic, but as time, particularly the pre-TV age, as time moves on and you've got no record of them. I mean, I think of this sometimes, and I think, you know, we voted Jimmy Johnson the greatest ever Celt. I only have the vaguest memories of seeing a faded Jimmy Johnson, vaguest memories. So evidence from TV. But I'm quite sure, but I always think of that and think, how could anybody not have voted Jimmy McGrory the greatest ever Celt? And if you go back in time and speak to people who watched Patsy Gallagher or Jimmy Gwynn, they'd be saying there's no way there was a better player. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I often think you can't have a greatest ever, because you and I didn't see that. How can you compare a guy who wore football boots that are worse, that are more difficult to walk in than the shoes I wear to work, and yet he played football in them, mm-hmm. and a ball that when it was raining weighed like a brick.
Mm-hmm.
How can you compare that guy with someone who's playing on a football pitch that never has an area that's worn out, like you see clips in the 70s even? You can't compare somebody playing in a modern Celtic jersey where they're playing in shoes that are almost like slippers to that guy, and you can't.
I think part of the issue, right, it's one of the reasons I'm not a complete fan of VAR, but one of the essences of football is disagreement. One of the essences of football is, you know, if football was purely clear cut, you know, everything is unambiguous, this is the answer, there's no debate, it would take away the relevance of the game. You need something where there's an ambiguity, you need something where you can have debate, you need something where there's uncertainty. And I think it's good to it's interesting to have the discussions about the greatest ever, but you're absolutely right. You can't really do the greatest ever because, you know, how would Henrik Larsson have done 100 years before? Well, in fairness to Henrik Larsson, if he'd been 100 years before, he'd have been used to that type of game,
Yes.
you know. But clearly, if we could somehow literally transport Henrik Larsson back to the 1890s, Henrik Larsson would have been battered black and blue every single game because that was just what happened. You know, it was a much more violent sport. And I think you're right to mention the likes of McGrory, even Melee. I mean, my sacrilegious unpopular opinion, you know, we were talking earlier about unpopular opinions, is right. Lisbon, the Lisbon Lions 67 is massively important. Of course it is. It's the pinnacle in the club's history. It is absolutely and utterly something that should be celebrated, never forgotten, not packed away at all or anything like that. But I think sometimes there's a certain danger that we make, you know, we are approaching now, we are coming on now for 140 years of Celtic history. And I think there is a slight danger at times that sometimes what we do is we basically say, well, there's the current team and there's the Lisbon Lions. And I know there's an inevitable aspect to that. Clearly, you're not going to celebrate every single team that has ever, you know, has ever wore the hoops or the stripes or whatever the case may be, depending on the era. But I think, you know, if you look at Celtic Park, I have no problem. You know, we have the Jock Stein stand, we have the Lisbon Lions stand, we have four statues at Celtic Park, three of which are Lisbon. And I've no problem again with celebrating, that's absolutely great. But I think if we think we've got a great history, then where's everyone else? Where are the other statues? Where is the statue of Jimmy McGrory, which absolutely should be there? Where's the statue of Willie Mealy? You know, like more, you know, a man more than 4 decades as manager. There's not even a discussion. If football lasts another 1,000 years, if the world doesn't blow itself up in World War III, no one's going to beat 43 years as official manager. It's just not ever going to happen. So you've got these really iconic people, but I just think at times there's an element, there's a slight danger where the history tends to be there's Brother Walfred, then there's about an 80-year gap. We get to Lisbon, and then there's the modern day team. And don't get me wrong, everything I just mentioned is hugely important. Of course it is. But I would like to see at times more things from the club. You know, if they have a much vaunted museum comes forth or whatever the case may be. But I would like to see something that says, yeah, these things are all great, but let's look at the legends. Let's look at the first team that won the Scottish Cup. Let's look at, you know, the six in a row, for example. I mean, how many fans, for instance, you know that, you know, six in a row, 1905 to 1910 league titles was massive. In many ways, was much bigger than even the later nine in a rows, because this was a really genuinely record-breaking thing that was hugely celebrated. And I think it's not really something that a lot of people would know. And you can never know everything, but I think it would be better if at times we broadened our history to more than some very broad brush. Well, there's this, then there's this, and there's the modern era. So again, that's what this is about. That's why a lot of the stuff I've done, whether it's walking tours, whether it's stories, quite deliberately doesn't look at things that, again, rightly have a focus. Of course, no one's ever going to doubt that is obviously the club's pinnacle, and it should be celebrated. But there's loads of other things as well. And that's really what a lot of that I do is hopefully about trying to, in my own small way, promote.
It's interesting you say that. I really like history. I think three or four of the podcasts I subscribe to are history podcasts, just in general stuff. But it's history of the last 150 years that I'm much more interested in because I just find it more relatable than the stuff that's 500, 600 years old. But I often think that history, particularly when you're talking about social history in the UK, is broken down into sort of couple of segments. There is the history post colour TV, there is history post TV, history post the Second World War, and there is a 1940 years of history that existed before the Second World War. It's like everything pre-Second World War doesn't really. There's a bit of discussion of where, well, we had some life and stuff, but nothing's really talked about. And almost like football's like that, very much like that as well. You know, the English Premiership's dreadful for this is a record since the Premiership began. And people of our age are saying, well, there was football before the Premiership. But you're right. I often look at, you know, you'll hear people, and I'm not decrying this, when they talk about, oh, maybe the Academy should be renamed or Lennox Town should be renamed, the Tommy Burns Academy or something like that. And I get all of that. But I also think, well, yeah, but, you know, we had a young player who died on the park. You know, shouldn't we have a John Thompson Academy? Or, my big thing is always Jimmy McGrory, because he was player and manager right up until, you know, we talked about the people on the bus. You and I know people who were Celtic fans when Jimmy McGrory, you talked about Willie Mealy, but to some extent that's even further away. But you and I were growing up with people who Jimmy McGrory was the Celtic manager when they were going to Celtic games. And I don't know if you, I always mention this one, one of my brothers was a ball boy at Celtic Park, and he continually goes on about one day, the ball boys were, you know, this is 82, 83, 84, around that time. One day the ball boys were all called in, and because they were unveiling a plaque inside Celtic Park, inside the main stand for Jimmy McGrory. There was a plaque for it being the Jimmy McGrory main stand that seems to have just disappeared. Like, utterly, he's adamant he was there. And I think I've seen somebody's managed to provide, I mentioned it before in the podcast, and somebody's managed to provide one picture from, I think it's about 82 or something like that, of Jimmy McGrory and his wife standing inside the main stand next to some wee curtain thing with a plaque. But nothing. But it seems to have completely gone away. And I often think, you know, the North Stand hasn't been named. It's almost as if we're holding off for at some point in the future we can name it the Fergus McCann Stand or something like that. But the main stand doesn't have a name. And as you're right, the sort of statues, we've got Brother Walford, but everything else is Lisbon and forward.
That's my... I have my slight issue about naming stands is it's quite short-termist. It sort of freezes things, you know, for a moment in time. So, as you see, you call it the Fergus McCann Stand, that's fine. I mean, that is there a point at which, what if at some point in the future there's somebody more important? Do you change it?
If Brendan wins the Champions League.
Well, absolutely. But do you know what? My view on this has been the part of me that believes in the collective rather than the individual in some regards was, when I was growing up, you know, I mean, I've got pictures of myself in Celtic strips, certainly going back to 86. You know, there's probably there's pictures of me before in Celtic stuff, but not strips. So from when I started getting strips that I don't actually remember having these, but I can see photos of myself, so I know I had them. Never at any point, right the way up, you know, probably till early 20s when I probably stopped. I have got a couple of strips that in more recent times, but I never ever used to get a name on them. I would never ever get any sort of name. And there was two principal reasons for that. One, I would have hated it beyond words if I'd got a player's name and they'd left. That just would have ruined the shirt for me. But you see, genuinely, I didn't think any player, even Paul McStay, Henrik Larsson, whatever else, was important enough to be on the strip. Because to me, the strip is what counts. The sort of, it's not about an individual player. You mentioned, you know, earlier, there's all these guys who were irreplaceable. Kenny Dalglish was irreplaceable. Henrik Larsson was irreplaceable. And so on. But they weren't. And the reason we know they weren't is they left and the club goes on. And I think on a personal level with that, I think, again, there's a slight danger that when you sort of go, because at this exact day we want to name a stand, well, yeah, but in some ways you're beginning to almost then freeze your potential ambition, because you've got two more bits of the Parkhead that could be renamed. So for argument's sake, you call it the Fergus McCann main stand or the North Stand, and you call the main stand somebody else. I don't know. It could be more historic. You could go back to Brother Walfred if you wanted to go back to the start. But then after that, that's it. And I like to think that what the club should be about, yes, is absolutely about celebrating history and about celebrating a lot of the history that maybe we don't talk about enough. But it's also about the history you're creating for tomorrow. You know, you think the 40 years from now, you hope that there's people going, oh, that new German forward we've signed, or isn't it great to see that young boy coming through at left back from Pollock, or whatever the case, you know, whatever the case may be. Everyone rightly has to have their own heroes. Everyone has to have their own people that define their Celtic experiences. And I say, I think there's sometimes there's a wee danger that if we if we try and pigeonhole the club's history down to very small number of things, including naming big permanent things that you can't really unname, not for a long, long time.
Yeah. Can you imagine the uproar if we said what we've decided the Lisbon Lions stand should go?
Absolutely. I mean, it would never be done. And in some ways, I can totally understand why you do it, but it's also quite short-termist. You know, it's something that it's a great idea immediately. And, you know, it's a bit like saying, do you think we should drown puppies? Well, no, I don't. You know, no one, if you say, do you think we should name the main stand, you know, we should name the stand after the Lisbon Lions, no one's going to go, oh, no, that's a terrible idea. But in the long run, the danger is you pigeonhole history. And as somebody, as I say, who teaches history, to a point that's inevitable. You know, there's some issues in history that I know genuinely lots and lots about. And I don't mean Celtic history, although clearly I know that. Uh-huh. But there's then other things of history that I know a very simplified version. You know, I could do a bit. If you ask me about the Crusades, you know, I could tell you roughly what it is. I can give you a basic sketch and outline. I certainly couldn't do any level of nuance. And I imagine that what I think of as the general outline of, say, something like the Crusades is probably wrong. I imagine if I spoke to an actual expert, they'd say, oh, no, that's one of these myths, or that's you're oversimplifying. And certainly I know, because the things I know lots about, people will say to me, including Celtic history, they'll say, oh, this happened. You'll say, well, no, it didn't. You know, that's maybe the simplified version that we've come to teach ourselves. There won't ever be a time, clearly, where everyone is an expert on everything in history. Of course there won't. And that includes Celtic history. But if nothing else, I hope that the walking tours I do, I hope that stuff like this maybe tweaks out, you know, certain other stories that people haven't heard before that might encourage them to, you know, go and read up more on it, or just keep alive a certain memory or a certain story that otherwise would have been forgotten.
So what sort of areas do you cover for the walking tours?
So various things. So both in a geographical sense, but also in a storied theme sense. So I've basically got, in terms of the consistent, in terms of the tours I do consistently, there's probably four that I do fairly regularly. So there is Celtic in the city centre. So I do a walk going around various, there's loads of really interesting both Celtic and Scottish football sites in the city centre. So I do that. I do Celtic in the south side as well, which is again similar. So usually start and end at the Queen's Park Cafe, and walk around various sites. Some of them are obvious, your Hampden and so on. Others, people, they're really big parts of the history, but people have no idea where you are until you say, where do you think we are just now? So I do that one. And the match day walking tour, which, as I say, is city centre, on a game, right out to the ground, and we stop at two or three pubs. I then, and when I say it, I've got four, that's the three consistent ones. But the fourth then is I throw in some of the other ones that I do. So I mentioned I did the Brother Walfred walk recently. I did a special walk. Actually, Matt McGlone came on it for the takeover. For the 30 years since the takeover, I have planned various other ones for future. I have got a West End plan sketched out. The north side of the city is too difficult because the only places you can get are too far apart. It'd have to be a bus tour rather than a walking tour. And I'd really thought next summer about, I've planned for a while, a Willie Mailey walk, telling the full life story of Willie Mailey. But I've been talking about moving that in with maybe the Celtic Foundation and trying to do a proper walk, like, you know, fundraising. If you want to come on it, you need to raise a certain amount, and so on. So there's various things like that. But as I say, so geographically, that's where I do them. Tend to do them at the nicer months of the year. So I'm doing one in October. That's quite late based on when I would normally do it. I would normally run them from about March till about late September, just because obviously weather-wise, I know it can be bad any time, but it's worse there. It can go the other way, though. I chanced my arm the 1st of January this year, did a south side one. Really popular. Loads of people came along, sort of get a blow away the cobwebs of Hogmanay. And it was glorious sunshine. I mean, it was absolutely beautiful. So you do that. And in terms of the topics you cover, it's particularly a lot of the club's early history, mainly because that sort of lends itself to the particular locations. You know, there isn't as many, although there is some, but there isn't as many stories about Celtic in, say, in the 2000s that allow you to visit these different sites as there is when you go back to the early history. But in particular, we'll look at a lot of the early history, the formation, the social culture of the time, the controversy, you know, the way that the fights that took place in the club's early years as well. You know, it wasn't again, that simplified the saccharine version of Brother Walfred wanted charity and he set it up and everyone was happy and lived happily ever after. As with most things, there's a semblance of truth in that, but if you actually understand the story, it's much, much more complex and it's much more complicated than that. So that tends to be where I do it. And as I said, the tours, you know, they've been really popular. As I say, there's no charge to come on them. I wouldn't want people to ever not want to come because they thought about money. On the website, I've got a charity donations page where, you know, it lists a series of charities and suggests you could if you want, but you really don't need to. And that, as I say, that's what I try and do. And hopefully the people that have come along, you know, there's been huge number. I mean, I've had a few hundred. If you count all the different tours I've done so far, some people have come back more than once because they've enjoyed them. But, you know, generally you're getting new people. And, you know, hopefully that's something that continues. It would be nice. It's the sort of thing you want to promote more because it's amazing how often that I mention something, or even in particular, people that I know say, oh, I mentioned something to somebody about that. And they go, oh, I'd love to do that. How do you find out about things like that? So again, you hope that by promoting it, people will find out more about these types of things.
So without spoiling your walks, you mentioned the Southside, and you'll say to people, do you know where we are? And then people get surprised. Tell me your big, if there is a big thing, that whenever you say to people, people are quite taken aback about a location or an event somewhere. Tell me your big star moment.
My favourite story on the Southside one, is about the original Calfkin Park, and the place that's had in Celtic history. You know, even a small version, the first ever place we lost an away game, for one thing. But more particularly, as a really big story, would be the 1902 British League Cup, which is just on so many levels fascinating because of the events that led up to it, tragedy, defeat, you know, ending up in this competition that, you know, shows the strange things about how you can't even trust what you read in newspapers back then, because of some of the reporting, and the funny thing about the fight that it caused between Celtic and Rangers in the aftermath, that in its own way still goes on. So I really love that. I love on the City Centre one, I really love going to the first place Celtic ever had a trophy award ceremony, which is really nothing to see. I mean, it's literally a delivery bay now at the back of a shop. And you go and you tell the story about the first trophy that we won. You tell the story about what happened. You also, not everyone who studies Celtic agrees with me on this, but the first trophy competition Celtic won definitely was the Glasgow North Eastern Cup. And that's a definite. And the original North Eastern Cup is at Hampden Park. You can see it in the museum. I'm not 100% that's the trophy that Celtic were first awarded. There was definitely, 100%, there was definitely another North Eastern Cup that was made the year we first won the competition. That's not a discussion. There was 100% a trophy. When we won that competition the year after, we got the brand new cup. We did. The newspapers are absolutely clear, the newspaper reports. No one knows where this trophy has gone to. It's completely disappeared, and I've tried to think. The last team to win it was Clyde. I've contacted them a few times without any luck. It's possible it's just been lost. It's possible that it's been repurposed. You know, for example, when we won the St Mungo Cup in 1951, the St Mungo Cup was not originally a football cup. It started out as a yachting competition trophy in the 1890s and had just been at different times repurposed. It's actually funny because when Celtic won the St Mungo Cup and found out it wasn't an original trophy, there was a protest and they demanded a new one, which they eventually relented on and kept. So I've always liked the idea that somewhere this trophy still exists and I'm going to find it. But the point is, again, there's all these little stories and there's all these places that you just have absolutely no idea that you're walking past something that in its own way was genuinely a big part of Celtic history. And again, that's what the tours, that's what a lot of the stories, you know, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's, you know, on the underground, whether it's the books that I've written, the books that I'm going to write that I'm partway through for the future ones, all these ones tell some of these tales.
So how do you do some of your research? I take it a lot of it is just trawling through the newspaper articles of the day. But as you've just said, again, just the nature of things, probably the older the newspapers, there might be less reliability around them just because a guy's going to somewhere on one day and it takes him 3 days before he can get in a position where he can write the article. So, and there's no photographs of it to give any proof to it. So, where are you getting all this information from?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's primarily primary research. I sort of feel like, as well as a Celtic season ticket, sometimes I feel like I've got a season ticket to the Mitchell Library. And the Mitchell's great, because they have got a variety of things, particularly things like the Scottish sport that you can't get anywhere else. There's also, you can't, there's some websites that have brilliant, like you can read the original newspapers going right the way back to, Celtic's formation beforehand. And you can get real detail and you can slightly truncate some of your searches, although research is still always best if you read the full thing, because there's some of the online sites where you can search for keywords, it will give you them partly, but it won't give you the full thing. And if you read it, you'll sometimes pick out a wee sort of bit of information. And I think one of the things that's interesting about research, whether it's online, whether it's the Mitchell or whatever else, is the little sort of detours that you end up taking yourself. So you can start off by saying, I am going to research this. And then you go, oh, look at this. I mean, so I'll definitely write a book about them. It's a running joke with some of my friends, but when I wrote the first book, this was a man I'd heard of, but really at a very, very broad brush, minor extent. But one of the early Celtic heroes was a guy called Mick McKeown. And Mick McKeown was a tough tackling back or defender. And I've just become utterly obsessed with Mick McKeown. I really, really have. I genuinely, it's one of these weird things. There's no one on earth knows more about Mick McKeown now than I do. There just isn't. I've got much of a book planned. I mean, it came to really what triggered me that this should be a book. I wrote for the Shamrock magazine that does, a lot of good Celtic history. I wrote an article, like just for them. And I sat and it was quite broad brush. And it was like, I'm at 11,000 words and I'm simplifying. I'm like, this is clearly,
That's not an article, Matthew,
no,
just to
it's
let you
not.
know. That's a novella.
But I became, and that came about because when I was doing the research for the league title, the first league title, so the book, I kept coming across the name McKeown. Now, again, it was somebody I knew that had been a Celtic player, Mick McKeown, but that was really the limit of my knowledge. And the newspapers, even after he'd left Celtic, would still talk about the bold McKeown, mix up to his old tricks again. And you're like, what is he doing that? And when you look at the story of Mick McKeown, it's actually a fairly tragic story. I mean, it's a horrific and horrendous story how he dies in the end. It's actually a story really of alcoholism and missed opportunities and early deaths and genuinely horrific deaths, and so on. So I just became completely obsessed by him and just spend a fair bit of my time. Every time I do any sort of research, I put time aside to do that part of him. And I've got so much. He's probably, it'll be the third or fourth book I write. And see, I'm midway through the next one. The McKeown one I will definitely do. But yeah, it's weird. But again, that wasn't something I planned. I didn't wake up and go, I think I'm going to find out about the life of Mick McKeown. Instead, it was very much finding something else and you do that. And the same goes with so many, so many other stories where you go to research one thing and you find out something and it just takes you down a completely different path, which is really interesting. It can be frustrating as well, because sometimes it takes you to what turns out to be a dead end. But the Mick McKeown one's a good example. I can do everything except at one point he goes from not really being able to look after himself but just about surviving to going to the poorhouse. And he has severe burns. And I don't know how that happened. And it might not be possible to find it out. At the end of the day, by this time, he was basically a homeless alcoholic. So, there's probably not any records. I keep finding the odd thing. You go, could that be him? And it's not. But so that bit of it's frustrating. But it's also really interesting because when you do find out something new and when you do solve a puzzle, you think, oh, that's absolutely brilliant. So personally, I really like this type of thing. I'm just waiting for that lottery win so I can do it full time, you know.
Well, maybe Celtic will build the museum, employ a full-time historian, and you're the man. So, conscious of time, I need to go and pick my boy up. Really vital information for the listeners. So tell people, you'll definitely be back on the podcast. You're going to be doing these people have been listening. You're going to be doing these 5-10 minute history snapshot things for us. So that's fantastic. You'll be back on the podcast. I've got something that I'll speak to you separately off podcast that I was planning to do. So we can speak about that. So tell people how they can find out about you, the books, the tours, the walking tours, and just generally what you, so tell you how you can find you online, read stuff, etc.
Absolutely. So the simplest one in terms of the Hail Hail History part of it is for people that use Twitter or X. So at Hail Hail History is the handle that I use. And obviously you can go into there and, you know, every day I post something. Sometimes it's a quiz. You know, I always do quizzes Monday, Fridays. Other days I have little themes that regularly go through, and I also quite like to do sort of long threads. You know, I mean, even the one at the weekend, I mean, the Brother Walfred one that I post at the weekend has about 250,000 views and so on in the end. Right. So, you know, you can see these sorts of things. Through that, you've then got a connection because in my Twitter biography, basically, it takes you to the Walking Tours website and so on. From the Walking Tours website, as I mentioned earlier, the easiest way to do it is to just directly search for it. So it's all one word, celticwalkingtours.wordpress.com. And from there, that takes you to the site. It tells you all about the walks. It tells you when the next walks are happening. I've got two more this calendar year. I've got the Hearts game on Saturday for the match day one, and then I've got one more match day one, which is the Aberdeen game in October. After that, I will bow to the Scottish weather and sort of next start scheduling once we get to slightly brighter October 2025 months. And other than that, for the book, as I say, the book, which was called The Bold Boys, glory to their name, you can still get it online. It's online from the Celtic Star, and actually it's in the Celtic shop, and that was really what I wanted. I wanted a nice looking book that was in the Celtic shop that I could go in and see. I've not yet been thrown out when I go in and I try to move it to a more prominent position if I think it needs to be promoted.
Well, we can all take it in turns. All those links that you mentioned there, we'll put them on the Substack website as well, so that people, when they go on for this podcast, they can go on and see those links and get them. But you'll be on more podcasts again. And with that, Matthew, I will say thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sunshine in your smile. We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision, and also subscribe to the CelticUnderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me